The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not Meir Shalev. I'm Uri Palti, Consul General of Israel, and I have the great honor of telling you that Meir Shalev is the Woody Allen of the desert. He's an Israeli author one is absolutely to read. Meir Shalev is a master storyteller whose magic realism is similar to the art of Gabriel Marcia Marquez. That's what wrote the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. These are but a few of accolades Meir Shalev, one of Israel's most celebrated novelists, has received in the international press. Meir was born in 1948, as the same as the state of Israel, in Nahalal, Israel's first moshav. He is the son of the poet and the author Yitzhak Shalev. He studied psychology at Hebrew University and went on to produce and host radio and television programs. He writes weekly satirical columns for the daily Yediot Acharonot, the most popular Israeli newspaper, works of fiction and nonfiction, as well as 8 books for children. Meir is a best-selling author in Israel, Holland, and Germany, and has been translated into over 20 languages. His novel, The Blue Mountain, is one of the top 5 bestsellers in Israeli publishing history. The New York Times Book Review says of his work, he delivers both startling imagery and passionate original characters whose destinies we follow through love, loss, laughter, and death. Meir is a recipient of numerous of international literary prizes, as well as the Israel Brenner Prize of 2006, the highest literary recognition awarded for his most recent novel, the work from which he will read this evening, The Pigeon and a Boy. Meir, if you... Please welcome. I must tell you, we were honored this afternoon to hold a reception in the consulate in honor of Meir. For us, it was a great honor, but my fault, I forgot to give you, on behalf of the consulate, a Philadelphia book. So I want to award it to you now, on behalf of the Israeli consulate. Please welcome Meir Shalev.
Thank you very much. Good evening. It's such a beautiful place and a beautiful hall, and I'm really thankful to be invited here. I will talk in English because this is the language of the audience, but I have to apologize before I start talking in English for my all the grammatical mistakes you're about to witness, all the lack of vocabulary. I will try to compensate you with a irrelevant story about the Hebrew and English language. My father, as our Consul General pointed out, was a well-known poet and writer in Israel and a Bible scholar. But when he was a younger person, he was, in the times of the Second World War, he volunteered to be a soldier in the British Army. And his job was to escort caravans of ammunition from the area of Haifa in northern Palestine. This is the name of our country then, to Alexandria and Tobruk, bringing ammunition to the armies of General Montgomery. So there were hundreds of trucks going south, and he was sitting in one of them with his rifle, and the driver was a British sergeant. It's a long drive. It's like five days drive. And they had to find something to talk about, and it was found out that the British driver was a very observant, pious, Christian believer So they talked about the Old Testament. And the British sergeant was amazed by my father's knowledge of the Old Testament, and in the end of the journey he hugged him warmly and he said, "You know, it had never occurred to me they translated this book into Hebrew as well." So you will understand that my Hebrew is much better than my English. I can even understand the Bible quite well, like many other Hebrew speakers, because Hebrew is indeed a very special language in which you can still understand texts that were written 3,000 and 4,000 years ago. This is a unique linguistic phenomena, and we are privileged to be born in this time in the history of our language. I'm here to talk about my new book. It's my last book in Israel. It was published in Israel about a year and a half ago. And it is, it was just published here, A Pigeon and a Boy, Yonah Ve'Na'ar in Hebrew. This novel contains two stories, two love stories. One story is the story of Yair Mendelssohn, a tourist guide in the present days in Israel. He specializes in migrating birds. Israel is the channel above which migrating birds are flying from Europe to Africa. Some people say they are the only tourists who still visit Israel so frequently. And Yair Mendelssohn takes bird watchers from all around the world to see those birds. He is unhappily married to his wife Liora, who is a very energetic businesswoman from America. She now lives in Israel, and his mother gives him a substantial sum of money so he can find and buy and rebuild himself a house somewhere else, and without saying it, it will enable him to leave his wife. And he does find a place, and he rebuilds the place with the help of a very special contractor. The contractor is Tirza. It's a female contractor. She used to be his girlfriend many years ago when they were in high school. Now she builds his house, and they have a love affair, a new love affair developing between them. And this story ends, not the love, but the story ends when the house, the building of the house is finished. So this is one present-day story. The other story takes place in the 40s of the previous century, starts maybe at 1940 or 1939, when a young boy in the Jordan Valley starts to work in a homing pigeon loft of the Haganah. The Haganah is the paramilitary organization of the Jewish population in Palestine before Israel was established. And the Haganah wanted to have as many as homing pigeons as possible in case of war. He works in the Jordan Valley, and there is a young girl about his age, half a year older, in another loft of the Haganah in Tel Aviv, in the old zoo of Tel Aviv, which doesn't exist anymore, I will say, for the Israeli young people who are here. This zoo was near the municipality building of today in Tel Aviv, and later it moved to another place. But at these times there was a homing pigeon loft, and this young girl is working there. They meet in one of the meetings of pigeon handlers from all around the country. They fall in love. They start sending love letters via homing pigeons. As a matter of fact, the first sentence he tells her, showing that he has interest in her, is, I want you to have some pigeons of mine, and I want to take home some pigeons of yours. It sounds a little bizarre to people who do not know the homing pigeons' habits, but all it means is I want to send letters to you and get letters from you by using the homing pigeons, and I have to explain because I from time to time I find out that people who do not have any experience with homing pigeons, and I'm one of them, by the way, should know. Homing pigeons cannot deliver a letter to an address. You cannot give the pigeon a letter and tell her, take this to Jaffa Street number 37 in Jerusalem. It doesn't work like this, and even the Israeli post office cannot cope with such missions. But homing pigeons know only one thing, and this is to go back home. This is her, I say her and she because I'm so familiar with homing pigeons by now that I treat it like a human being. But a homing pigeon wants to go back home. She knows how to go back home from great distances. And this is why the English language, so empathic, names this pigeon a homing pigeon, because that's everything about this creature. While other languages, and Hebrew included, call her like Yonat Doar in Hebrew, which means post pigeon or carrier pigeon or whatever in other languages, according to the use we make of this pigeon, but we have to respect the English language for calling this bird a homing pigeon. So they start to send letters to each other, and they meet from time to time in Tel Aviv in those professional meetings of pigeon handlers. And then when the war of 1948, the war of independence, breaks out. He joins the Palmach, the fighting units of the Haganah. He builds a homing pigeon loft in a kibbutz near Jerusalem. He takes care of it, but then he's called to join the battalion who will fight over a very famous place in Jerusalem, which is the monastery of San Simon. It's at the area of the neighborhood called Katamon. This is a very well-known battle in our history, a very fierce battle, almost lost and then won in the last moment. And I added a homing pigeon handler into this battle. There wasn't such a person. As a matter of fact, when I did the research for the book, I met the commander of this battle. He's 82 years old now. He lives in a kibbutz in the Galilee. I went to visit him, and he told me a little bit. He's not a great speaker. He's a reserved, silent kind of a man. But after we talked a little about the battle itself, I told him, I must tell you in advance, I'm going to add this pigeon handler to your battle, and he will dispatch a pigeon from this battle, and he will be killed. I tell you this because it's written already in the first pages of the book. He will be killed, and I want you to know all this before the book is published. And he smiled and said, there were so many lies already been told about this battle, you can add your homing pigeon. There is no problem. So I did. This is what I did, and many other writers do the same. We use a true story, and we tell it our way, adding or distracting elements from the story. So this pigeon handler, the boyfriend of the pigeon handler from the zoo in Tel Aviv, goes to this battle. He is terribly injured, terribly wounded by three bullets. And knowing he will not survive this injury, he manages to crawl back to his small portable pigeon loft that he carried on his back to this Bethel. And he sends a last letter and a last pigeon to his girlfriend in Tel Aviv. It's about 45 or 50 minutes for a pigeon to fly. We are a very small country, which is very good for homing pigeons. And this is his last letter to her. The content of this letter is the secret of my book. And this is what connects the two stories together and make them one story, one novel. I will not reveal this story because I guess that many of you have not read the book yet, and it shouldn't be revealed. And I ask you now that there are people here, I guess, who know this story, who read the book and know this story, and people do have questions about the secret of the book. And sometimes when they ask this question, they reveal unintentionally the secret. So I will give the answer already now. The answer is, yes, it is possible. Whoever read the story knows what I'm talking about. And so I protect my secret from being revealed. When I started writing this book, what I had in mind was only the house story, the building of the house. I didn't have any pigeon in my book when I started, and this is very strange for me because usually when I start writing a book, I know almost everything about my story. I know the rough lines of the story are clear to me. And so it happened that about 10 years ago, when I was 49, now you know my age, but Uriel, our consul general, disclosed my age even before. He said I'm the age of Israel, so it's very easy for me to remember how old I am. We will both be 60 next year, and I'm pleased to say I look much better. But when I was 49 and I was approaching my 50th birthday, I thought it's about time to buy myself a nice gift that nobody else bought me before, even though I was quite clear about what I want to get for this birthday, but I saw no signs of receiving it from others, so I decided to get it myself, and I found myself this little house, a Sochnut house, Beit Sochnut, Jewish agency house, we call it in Israel, in a small village, in a small moshav in the valley of Jezreel. I have a lot of sentiments to this area. In Israel, I was born there. I grew up part of my childhood there, and all my life I wanted to go back from Jerusalem to the valley of Jezreel, first because I'm very sentimental about this area, and then because Jerusalem is, and I really recommend to visit Jerusalem, it's a great place to visit, but living there is a completely different story. It's the relationships between Jerusalem and its citizens are very difficult. Herman Melville, your great author, was in Jerusalem 150 years ago for a week, and it was enough for him to tell that Jerusalem is surrounded by cemeteries, which is true. But then he added a beautiful sentence, and the dead are the strongest guild of this town, he said. And it is true. Till today, it is the dead people who run Jerusalem, not the mayor, not the municipality council, and not even the Israeli government. It is King David, Abraham, Muhammad, Salah ad-Din, Richard the Lionheart, they run the politics of Jerusalem. They are very influential dead people. And But I will come back to my story. I found this place, and I rebuilt it. I have to make a few things clear. There are differences between my story and the story of my narrator. I didn't get the money from my mother. I did not have a love affair with my contractor. She was a man, by the way. I feel so much relaxed now because I gave some lectures in the West Coast, in San Francisco and Berkeley, where I had to be very careful about the gender of my contractor. But here I feel more free to talk. Not that I have something bad to say about male contractors. I accept them as they are. But we didn't fancy each other, that's all. Anyway, he was a good contractor. He built a nice little house for me. And I didn't leave my wife and my home like Yair wants to do in his house. We did it together. I mean, after the initial surprise of me coming back home and informing my wife I just bought another house, she recovered quickly, and like she always does, and we built this place together, and we enjoy it together. But I remember very clearly this evening when I told her in Jerusalem, we were still in our flat in Jerusalem, and the house was finished. It's a little hot in here. I will take this. The house was finished, and I told my wife, let's go there. We have another place. It's something we never experienced before. And she said, but the place is empty, and there is no furniture, not a chair, not a bed, no nothing. Only doors and windows. I said, no matter, we'll manage. And we took a mattress from the house in Jerusalem, we put it on the roof of the car, and we drove to the Valley of Jezreel, and on the way we felt sort of like we used to feel when we were young students and we were moving from one rented room to another in Jerusalem with a mattress on our back, not on the roof of the car. And suddenly I told her, as if without planning it, I think I'm going to write a novel about this book, about this house, I'm sorry. About this house, and I started immediately the day after by describing the mother who gives Yair. I will read a few lines first in Hebrew and then in English. Halachti limtzo li bayit. Anashim acherim yorim be'atzmam o bezulatam. Ani halachti limtzo li bayit. Bayit she'irape, she'yeshakech, she'ibane bivniyato. שנכיר זה לזה טובה. הלכתי, מצויד במתנה המפתיעה שנתנה לאמי, ברצון להסביע את רצונה, במצוותה שצליל של חרתה נשזר בין מילותיה, כך יאיר, לך תמצא לך בית, מנוח לכף הרגל, שיהיה לך מקום משלך. For the non-Hebrew speakers, I would say this is the sound of our old language. I want to make this very clear. If King David and Jesus Christ opened this door and got into this hall, they would understand the sentences I just read, and I could discuss it with them, and I guess I will be highly criticized by both of them. In English, it is, I went to find myself a home. Some people shoot themselves or others, but I went to find myself a home that would heal and soothe and build me as I built it, and we would be grateful for each other. Off I went, armed with the surprising gift my mother had given me to carry out her will, the command she had issued with a note of regret threaded through her words, take this, Yair, go find yourself a home, a place to rest the soles of your feet, a place of your very own. this sentence, a place to rest the soles of your feet, is a translation from Manoach Lechaf HaRegel, which is a quotation from the book of Genesis of Velo Matza Hayona Manoach Lechaf Ragla, about the pigeon Noach dispatched from his ark to see if the flood, the waters of the flood receded by now, and the pigeon did not find Manoach Lechaf HaRegel, a rest to the soles of her feet, and came back to the ark. So the Hebrew language enables you to create such connections and associations in huge movements of pendulum-like movements above such long, very long periods of time and very long history of written material in almost the same language. When you write this sentence, you expect some of your readers, not all of them, of course, but some of your Hebrew readers to understand and to feel this kind of association. And I wrote this book, and I started to write this story, and I started to do research about contractors and builders and all the terminologies associated with remodeling a house. And I wanted to be, this is my habit, to be as reliable and true as possible, to create myself a solid ground from which I can take off in a literary manner whenever I'm able to. And then I decided to use the homing pigeon as a metaphor for one's love for his place, because this is what the homing pigeon is all about, loving your place, missing it, wishing to come back, to go back there. And I started to read some books. I had two children books about homing pigeons at home. One, by the way, is a book of an American writer, and a writer who wrote a lot about the wildlife of North America many, many years ago. His name was Ernst Thompson Seton. And I know that many Americans do not remember this name by now, but he wrote about 25 volumes of books describing wolves and wolverines and bobcats and deer and bears and raccoons and beavers and buffaloes and any other animal you have here in North America. One of his stories was about a homing pigeon in Canada who was working for a newspaper delivering news from the territories to the big city. A very nice story. And then I met, almost by accident, a man from a kibbutz in Israel who asked me if I have this book, the book of Seton that I was reading. And I asked, why do you want it? And I found out that this man is the greatest authority in Israel for homing pigeons. He knows everything to be known about pigeons, from the columbariums of Second Temple time in Beit Guvrin till the homing pigeons used by the Palmach and the Haganah. And he gave me a lot of information. I gave him the book to Xerox. You can't find it anymore. And I became more and more interested. And just for the sake of interest, I started to visit homing pigeon handlers in Israel and to see what they do. There are about 10 people in Israel or 15 people who still keep homing pigeons as a hobby, and they have races and competitions and whatever. But there were few people who are old people by now who used to handle homing pigeons for the Haganah and also for the Israeli army. The Israeli army kept homing pigeons from 1948 till 1957. And then it was closed, but it's interesting, and I met some people who did it. And then I met one of them, because most of them gave me the technical details of what the pigeons eat in the morning and what they eat in the afternoon, and when do they fly the first flight and when do they fly the second flight of the evening, and why do you give them marijuana seeds when they come back? You know that birds in general, but homing pigeons in special, especially they like very much the seeds of hashish, of cannabis. They are rich with energy, and one of the homing pigeons handlers, the old people, told me that when you start teaching the homing pigeon, she knows that she has to come back home, but she has to be taught to go directly into the pigeon loft, otherwise you cannot remove the message from her leg. If she stands on the roof of the pigeon loft, then it's no use. So she has to go back in. So they used to put some seeds of cannabis inside, so they will be taught to come in. And imagine this 80 years old man telling me this, and then he smiled and said, the pigeons really like those seeds. And after a while, we also like those seeds very much. Yeah. Anyway, then I met one of them who told me a story that made me understand that there is a great literary potential in the homing pigeon, much more than a metaphor for one's love to his home. This man lived in the center of Israel. From now on, I will become discreet. No addresses and no names. You will soon understand why. He lived in the center of Israel. He served for the Haganah and later for the IDF, for the Israeli army, handling homing pigeons for military use. When he finished his army service, he was 22 or 21, he decided he will build himself a loft as a hobby because he liked the pigeons very much. And soon people came to him and asked to buy pigeons because other people also wanted to have pigeons as a hobby. Homing pigeons from good breed and well-trained can be quite expensive. And he was selling these couples. One day, a man and a woman came to him from the Upper Galilee, from the north of Israel. And he started to tell me the story, and he blushed. I saw he was blushing. And I was very happy about it, because usually people of 82 years old do not blush anymore. Either they know everything, or they have circulation problems. But they do not blush. I know it from my own history. When I was 20, I used to blush like twice a day. And now it happens to me twice a year or even less. And mostly because of the wrong reasons. But this is another novel. Anyway, when he blushed, it was so nice to see such an old man blushing so nicely and fully, and I said to myself, this must be some story he's going to tell me. And indeed it was, because he told me that this man and the woman came to buy a couple of pigeons. And they bought a male and a female. He told me that the man was about 55 years old, the woman was about 40. They took the pigeons, and before they left, he told them, you must be very careful not to open the door of the loft in your place, because these pigeons will fly directly back here. They will come back to me, because this is their house. This is their home. Your homing pigeons will be the next generation and the next generation. These ones should never be released. You have to build a large loft so they can practice, fly a little bit inside, but never let them out. A week later, one of the pigeons came back. 5 hours later, the woman came. She had to go by bus all the way from the Upper Galilee to the center of Israel. In the early 50s, this was quite a journey. She came back tired. She came to fetch the pigeon, tired, thirsty, hungry. He gave her something to eat and drink. They had a little conversation. He again warned her not to open the door of the pigeon loft. She took the pigeon, went back home. 4 days later, the pigeon came back again. The woman, 5 hours later, tired, thirsty, hungry, bus, whatever. This time they were more friendly. They had a nicer conversation. They had nice lunch together. He cooked something. They talked. He gave her the pigeon back, said, you should be more careful, you know, not to open the door. She went back home. 2 days later, the pigeon returned. Then he understood. He was a young man. He was 22 years old. She was 40. Then he understood. They had this love affair going on for about a year and a half. She used to open. You know, I'm telling you the story from here. You can see only one face, which is mine, but I see all of you. And it's funny because most of the women are smiling and most of the men do not. Because we always fantasize about this possibility, but we never thought about using a homing pigeon, you know. All the time we think about, you know, false phone calls, motels, whatever, but homing pigeons, you know. Anyway, they had this love affair going on. I came back home and I told my wife the story. She also smiled much more than I did. And I said, listen, this is a great story, don't you think so? I told her, I think I will finish writing the novel about the house and I will write another novel about a couple or two couples and homing pigeons and love letters being delivered by homing pigeons and this kind of thing. I really like this story. And I wrote some ideas in my notebook and I kept on writing the story about my tourist guide and his house and his wife and his female contractor and his mother. And then one day, almost as if from nowhere, this idea that became the secret of the book just sort of landed on my window. It was unbelievable. One day as I was writing, it just came from nowhere, and immediately I understood that this is how I am not going to write two novels but only one. And the pigeons, the homing pigeon story and the house story are going to be connected together into one novel, and this is what happened eventually. There is something very, for me, is very cheerful that I have to tell you. Mr. Uriel Palti, our consul, told you about different prizes that I got in Israel, literary prizes, but nobody knows, including you, I guess, about two very special literary prizes that I got in Israel, and they have to do with the topics of my books, pigeons and birds and other creatures. These two prizes were given to me, the first on my first book and the second on my last book about A Boy and a Pigeon. The first one was given to my novel The Blue Mountain. Here in the original it is a Roman Russi, a Russian novel. And it was given to me, this is the literary prize of the Israeli Entomological Society. This is the prize of the insect experts. It was never given to any other writer before or after. I think that no other writer in the whole world ever got a literary prize from an entomological society. And in fact, it was the only time the Entomological Society gave a literary prize. I got it because in my first novel there are a lot of insects, most of them harmful to agriculture, because it's a book that describes lives in the village. And in Israel, till, I would say, the late 50s of the 20th century, insects and other creatures were divided to groups not according to the normal systematization of zoology, like insects and the birds and mammals and reptiles and all kind of groups like this. There was another division of classes, which was insects and creatures who are supporting Zionism and insects and creatures who are against Zionism. In my own zoology book, as a 10 years old student, it was written. There was a sentence. I quote it first in Hebrew because it's a beautiful language. Then I will try to translate. Beridetcha el asadeh, befogeshecha cherek zochel o yonek, sh'al oto, halanu ataim letzareinu. In English, when you go to your field, when you meet an insect or a mammal or a reptile, ask it, are you a friend or a foe? This, of course, is a quote from the Bible when Joshua met this angel of God with his sword standing in front of him, and he asked him, are you a friend or a foe? Halanu ataim letzareinu. So it's a question that should be asked because, for example, the black snake, Za'aman HaShachor, is a friend of Zionism because it is eating the mice who were eating the wheat of our Zionist farmers. The worst enemy of Zionism was the Anopheles mosquito, who infected the pioneers with malaria. I'm telling you this because on the small piece of parch that I got from the Association of Entomological Professors in Israel, it was written, this literary prize is given for the loving and accurate description of the humble lives of insects in Israel. And again, I think I'm the only writer to receive it. And then I got for Yonah Venar, for A Pigeon and a Boy, the literary prize of the Zoology Department of the Tel Aviv University and the Bird Watchers Association. Again, a single prize never to be given before. Which made me very happy because for me it is like the endorsements of rabbis to a Jewish book in medieval times. Like the big rabbis, the big experts gave me the stamp of their confirmation. This writer knows what he's talking about. I'm very happy about it because they didn't deal with my fiction, with my metaphors, with my style, with my syntax, vocabulary. Whatever. They dealt with the true stuff, whether I know what I'm talking about or not. In my home as a child, we were surrounded by stories all the time. In both ways, because my family divides into two... I have to see the time. I have to... Soon? Okay. So you want the story about my parents or about the donkey? No, it's impossible. It's impossible. I'll tell you I will tell you the story of my parents because it also gives an idea of the two sides of the family. We have in my family, which is a large family, we have my father's side. My father, as I told you, was a poet and a writer and a scholar and a teacher, and he is the city dweller from Jerusalem, and his family, most of them are writers and academia people and researchers and critics and editors and thinkers. And then there is my mother's family, 7 brothers and sisters, who most of them are farmers, cattle growers, but they are the storytellers. And their storytelling is sometimes, I think when I think about myself, is even more influential than the big library at my father's place. I remember my grandfather telling me about the little village in the Ukraine where he came from. And he said, we had a little shop in the village. We used to sell there different stuff. I said, like what? I was 4 years old or 5 years old. He said, we sold products for the body, products for the soul, and products for the in-between. I said, what do you mean? He said, products for the body were axes and hoes and boots and shovels for the Russian muzhiks, for the farmers. Products for the soul were sidurim and talit and tefillin for the few Jewish families who lived there. And I said, what is the for the in-between? He said, herring. And this is true. Whenever you saw him eating his herring with vodka, you could see this is a soul food. This is nourishes the body and the mind and the emotion together. Anyway, these two families became one when my mother, at the age of 18 years old, came from the village to Jerusalem for 2 months with a group of other youngsters her age from the village and other villages who finished their high school education, and they were sent to Jerusalem to get some courses at the Hebrew University to enhance their education and knowledge. These times, Israel was very interested in the education of her youngsters, not as we witness today. She came there, and there was one young guy from Kfar Yechezkel in the valley who was courting her, who wanted her company. They walked along Jaffa Road when a terrible rain started, a cloud burst, and he said, let's run and find shelter at my cousin's place. He lives very near here. They ran to his cousin's place. This was my father. This is how they met. In the years to come, when me and my sister were little children, my father used to tell and retell this story. He was a secular person, but he treated this rain as if it was given to him by God. Otherwise, my mother would not come to his place. And he used to tell us, and now, children, what would have happened if this rain did not come down? And he said, then your mother and myself would not have met, and you would not have been born. Now, at the age of 4 and 5, this is not a very positive message. We looked at each other sort of dizzy. And then he added, or maybe you would have been born, but to other people. And then you would not have been yourself. So in this kind of storytelling, I grew up. Herrings and doubting your own existence. And in this manner, I try to write my stories today. And if you have any remark or a question for me or about my book, or I will try to answer. Thank you. Yes, please.
I read the book in English. I don't speak or read Hebrew. Did you read the book in English? I'm just interested to know, because I would never have thought that it was a translation. It was so beautifully written in English, or so beautifully translated in English, that I just wondered if you had any input into the English translation at all.
I had a small input. I'm very happy you are saying this. As a matter of fact, English is the only language in which I can work with the translator a little bit, because I'm translated to many languages. And English is the only one I know. One of my children's books was translated to Japanese. Japanese are very orderly people. They sent me printed material for proofreading. And I thought to joke and tell them that I really don't like the last two lines on page 4. But my agent told me that if I will tell this to a Japanese publisher, he will take another translator, and the book will be postponed 5 years or so. So I wrote back that I think it's an excellent translation, the best translation I ever had. And anyway, I had a chance to work a little with my translator. His name is Evan Follenberg. He is American, living in Israel. Very, very talented translator. And I'm very glad you said that, because you know English better than I do. He had some questions, of course, mainly about some biblical phrases that I put in my book, and also about a terminology that has to do with the building and pigeon handling, which I looked for him and asked the experts to help us. And not only that, this is funny, but I never read my books after I write them. I finish the book and it is published, and I don't read it like the reader reads it from the book, because I don't want to see it anymore. So the fact is that the only way I read my books is the English translation. I read my books only in English. And it's very interesting for me, because this is the only chance I have, because Evan sent me his translation. I had to read it and put some question marks or exclamation marks here and there. So I was involved, but very only in necessary stages of work. And it's his credit, and I'm very grateful to him. Yes, please.
I read your books in Hebrew, and for me, your books are extremely Israeli. They speak of my home. And I always wonder how people that read them in other languages can relate to them, because they're so Israeli.
Where do you come from in Israel?
I actually grew up in a moshav, so for me, the opening scene of Roman Rusi is like reading home.
Where?
In Betchen, it's in Emek Hefer.
Yeah. Because in Israel, people from the Moshavim, like yourself, telling me, how can the people of Tel Aviv understand this book, you know? And now you say, how can the people from America or Germany or Greece or Portugal can read your books? Well, they can. They simply can. The same way I read Mark Twain as a little boy, he wrote about a reality so different from my own, and about a different time, different language, different geography and place. And yet, I read him, and I could identify both with Tom Sawyer and with Huckleberry Finn. And the widow Douglas was just like many other old ladies in my village. I had no problem about it, and I could read the translation of Gogol from Russian to Hebrew and like it very much, and many other books. And of course, when you translate a very local book from one language to another, you lose some things. But I also think that the foreign reader sees things that the local reader, since he is so familiar with what is written in the book, does not notice anymore. So there are the advantages and disadvantages of a translation. And after the initial shock when you read yourself for the first time in a different language, I think my translators are doing a very good job. Yes, please.
How long did it take you to write your book?
It took me the same as it took me for the other books, about 3.5 years it takes me to write a book, and I work almost daily. I do not work Saturdays, and I do not work Wednesdays, because on Wednesday I write a column for the paper. All other days I work for my on my books, and this is my pace. I'm a slow writer. Yeah.
What's the point of Dr. Laufer talking in feminine plural, and how was it translated into English?
Okay. This question is for the... I will explain it because the people who did not read the book should know. The chief pigeon handler in Israel, Dr. Laufer, a character that never existed. I made him up. There was not such a figure and not such a man. Is a Yeke. You know what's a Yeke? A Yeke is a Jewish immigrant from Germany to Israel. They are known for their funny mistakes in Hebrew. He talks in the plural feminine grammatical form, even though he should talk in the masculine singular. Hebrew makes a difference between the genders in the verbs. I think he does it because he identifies with the pigeons. And the pigeons are feminine in the Hebrew grammar. When you talk about a flock of pigeons, it doesn't matter that there are males and females together. It is always feminine. So he talks in the feminine form because he is like one of the pigeons. It was solved by in the English, since we do not have a difference between, let's say, af and afa, fly for masculine and fly for feminine, we solved it by we ladies do such and such. Or this was the only way to solve it, and this was the solution of my translator. Yes, please.
As you mentioned in your book,
it's okay. I will repeat the question. Yeah? Good.
If you insist.
You have to teach those Israelis some manners. Yeah. Good, very good. Yeah.
So you make a lot of connections and insinuation into the Old Testament.
Yes.
And there's one particular that I'm not sure if you actually intended it. You talk a lot about the relationship between children and their parents in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the brother of Yair, her name is Benjamin, and the father is Jacob.
Yeah.
Kind of Benjamin is Jacob's favorite son in the Old Testament. I was wondering if it was intentional or...
This time it was not. This example you gave, it was not intentional. Because first I use the character of Jacob many times in my books because he's my favorite biblical character. And I find in his personality many aspects and traits that give me some kind of inspiration in my writing. But this time I did not mean to create this connection of Benjamin and Jacob as son and father. These are just common names in Israel. Usually the way I use the Bible in my books, sometimes by names, but not really in this book, but in other books I have other Jacobs, where the Jacob is more significant. For example, in my book Esau, of course, the brother of Esau is Jacob, and he is the main character of the book. And I think I found some similarities between the biblical characters and my characters. But I also use names of friends and relatives in my book. And in this book, there are at least two characters who got their names because one friend and one relative called me very angrily and said, "You already used all the names of the other relatives and friends and you never used mine." So I did it. This is a This is the mother, Raya, is a friend of ours. And the narrator, Yair, who is my youngest uncle, and he was a little offended, and he said, you used this uncle and this uncle and this aunt, and I'm always neglected. So I used his name, because some people think that it has to do with my own name, because Yair and Meir are very similar, and as a verb, it's the same root. This is in the present tense, this is in the future tense. But I used it because my uncle wanted to be mentioned in the book. Yeah. Look, if his name was Zerubbabel, I will not use his name. But Yair is a good name, is a simple name. It doesn't make any kind of associations that cannot be understood. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
What's next? The next book.
What the next book? Well, I'm writing now a second collection of, we are talking about the Bible. I already published years ago a collection of essays about the Old Testament, called Tanakh Achshav, Bible Now. I hope it will be translated to English. It was already translated to several languages, where I write and interpret biblical episodes and characters in a political, secular, literary manner. And it was very popular in Israel and still is, and it I think it brought many young people closer to the Old Testament. And now I write another collection about more characters and episodes in the Bible that I did not write then. And I also have already a story in my mind for a new novel, and I'm in the middle of research for this novel, and I hope to start it soon. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.